Judiciary Committee come to order. Today is February 3rd. And we'll open the meeting first with a review of the rules. Everybody have a chance, hopefully, to take a look at the rules. If there's any questions about the same, they're the same as the last session. No questions? Representative Krieger?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to
see, I'll move to work session on that.
I'd like to have the House Judiciary Committee rules as presented adopted.
Representative Krieger moves that we adopt the rules as presented. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4035.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4035 comes to you from the chair of this committee, allows a corrections officer employed by the Oregon Department of Corrections to possess a women of weapons, excuse me, in the offices, personal vehicle when the vehicle is in a DOC parking lot, if the officer is present in his or her official capacity, he or she has a valid Oregon concealed handgun license, and three, the weapon is in a locked gun box inside the vehicle.
Okay. First call, Leonard Williamson. Please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Leonard Williamson. I'm currently the Inspector General for the Oregon Department of Corrections. Chair Barker and committee members, we have submitted some written testimony. I'm hopeful that that has made it to all the members. I'm going to skip over what the bill does. With respect to the issues created for the Department of Corrections, the department has historically opposed this concept for two reasons. One, the security and safety challenges the concept poses for operation of Oregon's prisons. And two, the significant legal liability issues that are raised by permitting firearms on the grounds of our correctional institutions. However, we recognize that there are also competing personal safety concerns that this bill attempts to address that are important to our employees and to the department. These concerns include, but not limited to, the safety of our staff as they commute sometimes long distances between work and home. We have yet to fully explore the liability issues raised by this concept with the Department of Justice and the Department of Administrative Services. We believe that it's critically important that we in the Legislative Assembly fully explore these issues as part of any policy discussion of this concept. If, after complete and thorough review of these issues, we conclude that the legislation in this area is warranted, the legislation must properly address the department and the state's liability risks. Finally, we are concerned that if there is to be legislation in this area, subject to further review, the legislature should address the personal safety concerns of all of our employees with concealed handgun licenses and not just the security staff. The action that we're requesting at this time, the department is committed to work with our labor partners and other stakeholders to ensure the safety and security of our institutions, facilities, the safety of all of our employees, our adults in custody, and the public. However, the policy and legal issues raised by this concept are many and complex. There is simply not enough time during this short legislative session for the department to obtain and evaluate information necessary to conduct a complete, thorough review of the issues raised by this concept and time to provide the body, our public body, with our recommendations. For these reasons, the department urges that the committee not move House Bill 4035 out of committee this session in order to permit the department the time it needed for the next regular session of the Legislative Assembly to conduct a complete and thorough exploration and evaluation of the issues raised by this concept. We look forward to and for the opportunity to report back to this body with our findings and recommendations. At this point, we determined that there's no fiscal impact to this bill.
Okay, thank you. We had this bill last session, and it didn't get a hearing because it was caught up in the politics of the building, because it said the word gun in it. And I'm a little surprised because we didn't hear anything from DOC at that time when the bill was out there. It's essentially the same bill. And then one of the things I would say, and I've been playing phone tag and have not been able to hook up with the director yet today, is that one of the things I think might be a possible solution would be to have a gun locker like they do at courthouses and so on. When I was a detective, I went to OSP down here to interview a suspect in a murder case. And I, of course, brought a gun with me, but I checked it in outside. I didn't leave it in the car. But so I would wonder if DOC would be amenable to setting up some kind of a system like that where so the people could, for their own safety, carry their concealed weapons, but then check them in. If there's concern about them being stolen out of the car, and then the other thing, if you've got trustees that aren't trustworthy, maybe they shouldn't be out there mowing the lawn to begin with.
Chair Barker, that is one of those options I think that we'd like to explore with our labor partners. There would be a fiscal impact to the department if we provided not only a space, but the lockers themselves.
Okay. Any questions, committee?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Mr. Williams, when you were describing your two points, your position, I did not quite understand your first point that you were making because you went through that really fast.
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, do you mean the security and safety challenges with respect to?
Yes.
Okay. The safety challenges, clearly, as Chair Barker pointed out, would be allowing those weapons left out in our parking lots where we presently today have inmate custodians out in those parking lots policing the grounds. We do that at every single one of our facilities. To remove the inmates from the grounds means we'd have to hire employees to go out there and do the same job at an additional cost.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of following up on the sheriff's position, you've had 7 months that you knew there was a bill there. Why haven't you been working with the unions on the issue over that 7 months? Obviously, it was going to come forward.
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Krueger, I've attended many of our labor meetings that we have monthly with labor. In the 7 months that I've been participating in those, I don't recall this coming up that often, if maybe just a side discussion about whether or not we could have a conversation about them. We recognize at this time, though, that this is a different world that we're in, that our employees do face different challenges, and we'd like to have a conversation with them about how to meet those safety challenges.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure this bill does what it's intended to do, and I'm basing that on the Medford school case, where the school teacher wanted to bring a firearm on school, and the courts basically said the school district's internal employment policy does not represent the sort of exercise of authority to regulate firearms that the statute preempts. So we're talking an employment issue. I also look at the current possession of firearm statutes, and you've got to conceal by the statute. If you have a concealed handgun permit, you can carry a gun in the public building. This might seem absurd, but Department of Corrections property of public buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that raises some interesting issues, too. So I just want to bring out those two issues, Mr. Chairman's committee.
Okay, thank you. And the prisons are allowed to condition what can come in their building and what they call contraband and things that normally would not be contraband, for example, a cell phone you can't take into the building. And so on.
That's true, Mr. Chairman of the committee, but I'm not sure what contraband means. If you have a right to carry, it may not
right.
be contraband.
Well, they use that term contraband for things that are legal to carry for other people. Mm-hmm. And this is primarily a safety issue. The employment thing, of course, that was somewhat different in that that was a teacher wanting to carry a gun into the school. These men and women do not want to carry a gun into the prison. They want to be able to have it to and from work. So thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I know for the Americans with Disability Act, for example, prisons, while public buildings are also public places and they can be segmented even within the space. So I know this it seems appropriate. It seems like my thought is the bill probably would accomplish what it sets out to do if going on that precedent. But I wanted to bounce that off of council or.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if we go forward with the bill, I think it should be clarified.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Kevin Sturt and Jack Dempsey. Please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Starr with Oregon Firearms Federation. We're entirely supportive of the idea behind this bill, but I think some points have been brought up that make it a problem, and I don't think it really gets us where we want to be. If you look at the language of the bill, it refers back to, it says, notwithstanding 166.370. But if you look at 166.370, that specifically exempts corrections officers already. I think, as Mr. Taylor pointed out, the problem is not that we have a statute that prevents corrections officers from traveling with guns, but that their own department has rules that prevent it. And in our Medford teacher case, as Mr. Taylor pointed out, the court said that while you can't create laws or ordinances without the legislature's approval, you can create a condition of employment. And I think it's the condition of employment issue that has to be addressed. I don't know how you would do that without addressing it through the preemption statute. The preemption statute doesn't mention conditions of employment as one of the things that's proscribed. And I think it could be done. So I think that it's a great idea, but technically it's not making too much sense to me. And the other, I had three other things that I was wondering about. Why the bill repeatedly references weapons instead of firearms. I haven't been able to find a definition for weapon in the statute. I found a definition for deadly weapon and a definition for dangerous weapon, but I don't know why it says that. I'm not sure why it's requiring a person to have a concealed handgun license, because currently you wouldn't be required to have a concealed handgun license to have a firearm in your car if you follow the rules about how it was transported. And finally, I wonder why we use the term gun box, which I don't know what a gun box is. Now, I've heard from a number of corrections officers who obviously strongly support this and understand the need to have some kind of security because there are prisoners in the parking lot. But I don't understand why people who work in a dangerous environment are denied the same rights that I have. I can travel to and from a Department of Corrections facility with a gun, and they can't. And I think that that really needs to be fixed. I just think that we might have to find a way to do it that actually addresses the problem, which is conditions of employment, not existing statute.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Starrett? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Jack Dempsey representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Want to put our strong support behind this measure. We think this is a critical measure for officer safety. I don't want to take testimony from Mrs. Bakken, who I know is going to come up behind me, but we did lose an officer, Buddy Heron, a few years back, who was driving to work and was being a good Samaritan and was killed on the roadside. And we have talked to his widow, and we know that he has, during that time, had mentioned in the past how this was an issue for him, and he felt unsafe. He was out in Pendleton and driving long distances, and I think that's just one incident too many to prevent this measure from going forward.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Dempsey? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Botkin, Don Loving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here today representing the American Federation of State County Municipal Employees. We represent roughly 4,000 people working in the Department of Corrections, and this is not the first or the second time this bill has been introduced, but probably the third or the fourth. It has been an ongoing issue for our officers that sort of came to a pinnacle last session when Now, understand that prior to last session, there was no real issue about whether or not officers had weapons in their cars. I've worked for AFSCME for 30 years. For 30 years, officers have been carrying their personal weapons back and forth to work in their cars, securing them in the parking lot with no incidences. Last session, DAS and DOC put together a new rule that said no weapons on state property. Unfortunately, they included parking lots in that. That then made it questionable as to whether officers had the right to continue to carry their personal weapons in their vehicles. I know of no instance whatsoever, in my knowledge, where an inmate has broken into a car, stolen the weapon and tried to take it inside the prison, or stolen a weapon and gone somewhere else and done bad things. Never have I ever heard of that. I have heard of officers having problems on the roads because they're wearing a uniform with a badge and they don't have the authority of a police officer. This is about their personal safety. Mr. Dempsey referred to Buddy Heron. Buddy Heron was one of our members. I don't think anybody will ever know if Buddy Heron had had a weapon, if it would have mattered. You know, you don't know whether he would be alive today if he had had his personal firearm with him at the time, or if he had taken it out of his car when he went to help a, quote, stranded motorist. We don't know that. What we do know is that it magnified the concerns of 4,000 of our members, that they are at risk, and that carrying their personal weapons in their vehicles, they are responsible, trained law enforcement members of the law enforcement community. They understand the risk, and they are responsible with their weapons. And I'm sorry if it's I think Kevin said they're called firearms. I'm sorry. So to suggest that they would not somehow be responsible with their firearms in their personal cars now, any more than they have been for the last 30 years, is ridiculous. And, you know, we probably didn't need a law till somebody decided we needed a rule. And if the bill was written improperly, then let's amend it. You know, amending it is pretty easy. And right now, what we need to do is to continue to offer these men and women who work in Oregon's prisons the same protection that they've had for many, many years without incident and just move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
I would hope, Mr. Chair, that you'd allow Mary and Kevin and a couple of people to get together, preferably today, and see if there is an alternative in wording and allow that to come forward.
And thank you. Does Council Taylor have time to be participate in that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, yes, he will. Yeah, he will.
Krieger and Barker. Yes. He can give up his night and lunch and dinner.
Yeah, I do have two meetings right after this.
Okay, Don?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to emphasize a couple of points.
Identify yourself, please.
Yes, Don Loving. I'm the communications director for AFSCME, and so in that role, I've done a lot of work with on the Buddy Heron incident since that happened in 2011. And you want to emphasize that, you know, he thought he was helping a stranded motorist on the side of, you know, it's a very lonely stretch of Highway 10. He got out, he had a uniform and a badge on, and the apparent stranded motorist was, in fact, a 19-year-old youth who already had a long criminal history, saw the badge, saw the uniform, panicked, and fatally stabbed Officer Heron, who was just trying to do a good thing. This bill is all about safety commuting back and forth to work, and is getting clouded by, you know, these other concerns that we frankly don't feel are concerns. You know, firearm, gun, weapon, whatever. It's going to be locked in the parking lot securely. It's not going into prison. It's not going to get in the hands of the inmates. That's never happened. You know, escapees from our prisons don't escape from the prison. They walk away from work crews that are way out away from the prison. So that simply isn't an issue. You know, right, wrong, or indifferently, you know, in the 90s, we embarked on this big prison building campaign, and we put them in places like Pendleton and Umatilla and Ontario and Lakeview and Madras, and it's not unusual for our folks to drive 90 minutes one way on very lonely roads to get there because those areas aren't big enough population-wise to support those prisons without coming from a large hinterland. And so this is simply about letting our folks be safe on the way to work and on the way home from work, especially those who work swing and graveyard shifts. It's nothing to do about having guns in the prisons. Thank you.
Would you object if they were able to set up some kind of a gun locker system, like I mentioned? I don't know if you heard the first time.
So not at all. I mean, we are, let me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Botkin again, let me just say that we are prepared to accept any reasonable solution to the problem. We are looking for a solution to the problem that our members face being a part of this community. And, you know, if we need to have gun lockers and the gun lockers are going to cost money, then, you know what, maybe we'll do a fundraiser. You know, maybe the union will pay for the gun lockers. You know, I mean, if that's the issue, then, you know, then maybe we'll take, you know, then maybe we'll do something to make that happen. But the reality is that there have been no documented problems. In all the years I have worked for this union, I have never heard of a problem with an inmate gaining access to a weapon inside of an officer's car. What I do know is that an officer was killed without a weapon. And so, you know, I think that there's a point where the officers and the staff get to say, I need to feel safe in my commute back and forth working where I work.
And then they are exposed to some very dangerous people. So I would like you, if you could, especially if you talk with the Department of Corrections as well, but Mr. Stewart had some very valid points. So we need to say firearm instead of weapon because we don't know what that is. And we need to define what a locked box means for the purpose of this statute as well, if we're going to pass that. So I appreciate his input on those things. And if you could see, we can't get this resolved. I think all the members want the guards, the corrections officers in Oregon to be safe going to and from work.
And I'm more than willing to, Don and I are more than willing to sit down and have those conversations and find out if there isn't some middle ground that we can come to here.
Mr. Chair, just one other thing, too. Mary, it sounds like you're okay then with supporting the idea of a concealed handgun license being involved in that, too, for that.
I think that demonstrates some level of knowledge.
Competence, yeah.
And competence. You know, most of our staff have had weapons training, but if there's something that goes along with a concealed carry permit I have not gotten any pushback from any of our members about requiring a concealed carry permit.
And I would think that also would relieve the state of some liability, too, if somebody they've had instruction on the law so that you don't have problem. But like Mr. Stewart said, though, anybody else, I can drive over and park my car in the prison and leave a gun in it, although I would be hesitant to do that, but without having so.
I'm fine with that.
Okay, any further discussion? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4035 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4048. Is Representative Witt here yet?
Chair, members of the committee, I understand Representative Witt and possibly Senator Johnson are on the way.
Okay.
This bill comes to you from Representative Witt. It allows the family of a deceased person to sue the state or a local government entity or their employees for wrongful death so long as the government entity was not the employer of the decedent. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, currently if you are covered under workers' compensation, regardless of whether it's your employer, you could be employed by a private entity. And under the Tort Claims Act, you are precluded from maintaining a wrongful death action under those circumstances. So it's.
We had a hearing on that last
Mr. Chairman, yeah. Yeah. We've had hearings on this.
I'm trying to get it resolved.
Mr. Chairman, just if I recall correctly, was that the incident?
Jennifer Warren.
That's exactly right.
That's correct.
Yeah.
You had a situation, you'll hear about it probably from the family.
Okay.
Woman was employed by a nonprofit organization that provide health care services in Columbia County. She was asked, one employee refused to go out and interview this guy who was under the jurisdiction of the PSRB because he had been in the state hospital. She went out and was killed. Okay. And because she was under workers' comp, paid for by her nonprofit organization that she worked for, her only action was under workers' compensation, which meant because of her family situation, the kids were older, was limited to about $15,000. Okay. So that's, they'll be up here to testify.
And justice there. I remember the case well.
First I'll call Rob Bovet, Scott Winkle.
Rob is from the other side. You may want to
raise again. We're in the pros first.
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, we'll have Aaron Knott. Mr. Sahagian.
Judge, pardon. Judge. Chair, I also have Jesse Warren.
Please.
I've heard her come up with me.
Yes, please.
Would you like to read the committee?
Please.
And I know Representative Witt wants to be here also to testify today.
He's on the way. But
okay, great. If I may, just real briefly, not in my spill, but this is Jesse Warren. This is the daughter of the lady who was murdered. And the granddaughter's out in the hallway. And you're going to meet her also. Just to refresh, and I appreciate Representative Barton, but to refresh everybody's memory, this is the lady who, again, was working for Columbia Community Mental Health,
okay,
a public nonprofit. She was sent out to give meds to a person who had already under the care of PSRB for attempting to murder his mother, and this lady was murdered, and this is her daughter. She would like to read a statement to the committee, and I'd like to go further about what we're doing here today.
Okay, and Mr. Sahagi, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
And I am Mike Sahagian. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I've been hopefully pushing this bill along, and I'll definitely defer to Representative Witt if he'd like to go first. Representative, this is Jesse Warren, the daughter.
Jesse, hello. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm State Representative Brad Witt from Oregon's House District 31, here appearing before you today in support of House Bill 4048, which is intended to correct an anomaly in Oregon statutes. This anomaly came to light following the murder of Jennifer Warren back in 2012. Jennifer was murdered in the course and scope of her employment. She was working for a nonprofit when, as part of her job, she attempted to deliver medication to her assailant who killed her. As such, Jennifer's death constituted a workers' compensation claim against the nonprofit agency for which she was working. Her death was compensated in the amount of $16,000. At the time that she was attacked, Jennifer's assailant was under court-ordered supervision by the State of Oregon's Psychiatric Security Review Board. It was an established fact that her murderer was capable of extreme violence, having tried to murder his own mother. I would argue that under no circumstances should the State of Oregon ever allowed him to have unguarded contact with Ms. Warren, or for that matter, anyone else. But the state did, and Ms. Warren died as a result. Her death was not an accident. She died from an attack by someone who was under supposed supervision by the State of Oregon. Now, this situation sounds like it's set up for a third-party wrongful death lawsuit, but that is not possible under current Oregon state statutes. As you will see on page 2 of the bill, lines 5 through 9. Every public body is immune from liability for any claim for injury or death of any person covered by any workers' compensation law. This section precludes anyone covered by workers' compensation from suing a public body, regardless of the circumstances. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I submit to you that the exclusive remedy provisions of our state's workers' compensation law were intended and established to protect employers from lawsuits by their own employees. That was the big trade-off in workers' compensation. As an employee, I am injured or killed, and I have uncontested rights to workers' compensation insurance. The trade-off is my exclusive remedy is the workers' compensation insurance. That relationship is between me and my employer. The statute was not intended, or the workers' compensation, was not intended to preclude third-party lawsuits, particularly in the very limited instances of wrongful death. I am unaware of any other situation under workers' compensation where an employee's exclusive remedy relationship with his or her own employer is extended to another and different third-party employer. That is the genesis of House Bill 4048. That is why I'm here asking for your help in addressing this problem that involves only a handful of people. And that, committee members, is why I am asking for your help to address this problem. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Representative Witt? Thank you.
Chair, if I may, to put a human face on this, this is the daughter of the lady who was murdered. She's 23, believe it or not. She's never testified anything like this before, never been to this building before. She's prepared a written statement, and she'd like to read it to you with your permission.
Please. My name is Jessica Warren. I'm 23 years old. I just had a baby, March 26th, a little girl named Keely, and she was out in the hallway. I will try to be brief, but I want to make sure you understand the importance of your work here today. Before I begin, I should let you know that I have hearing disabilities, so my speech may sound a bit funny to you. On May 20th, 2012, my mother was murdered while working for a company that delivered medication to the mentally ill. Brent Redd, the person who murdered my mom, was under supervision of the Psychiatric State Review Board. This state agency thought it would be okay to allow Brent Redd to be released into the St. Helens community after he was convicted of attempted murder of his own mother. The attorney for my mom's estate had explained to me that there is currently a law that did not allow my mom's estate to make a claim against any government body because she was covered under workman's compensation through her own employer, Columbia Community Mental Health. I cannot express in words how the murder of my mom had affected my life. I miss her so much that I cannot explain it to someone who has not gone through this before. As I understand the current situation, we are only asking to change the law in situations where there is a wrongful death claim against the government body. Even when the person making the claim was unemployed by another company because my mom was covered under workman's compensation. The only benefit we have received were for her funeral expenses related to her death. As my little girl is waiting out in the hallway for me, I'm going to end this statement by having you meet her. She will never meet her grandmother, who was murdered by Brent Redd, on behalf of my whole family. Please give us a chance to be able to make a claim against the government bodies who allowed Brent Redd to come back into our community without supervision. Thank you.
And with your permission, I'd like you to meet the granddaughter. She's out in the hallway, and I just want to put a human face on what we're trying to do here today. You go and get your daughter, and you go ahead and leave. Granddaughter of the woman who was murdered. So we want to make sure we put a human face on this because you'll be hearing a lot of other things, and we want to address those too. Thank you. You're free to go home if you like. Okay?
Thank you very much for your testimony.
If I may, I'd like to say a few more words. And this bill has been worked over to hopefully have it ready for this session. It strikes me that what you're going to be hearing as this bill is trying to be passed is people are trying to make an exclusive remedy argument. As Representative Witt has made very clear, this has nothing to do with the exclusive remedy. This is a claim against a third party, which would be allowed if it was a private party. If it's a government party, you cannot. And again, we're talking about only wrongful death claims, not injuries. I've put written testimony, but I want to make it part of the record in case this ever comes up again after this bill is passed. So anybody looking at this, and the Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, will make it very clear. John Schiltz at the Workers' Compensation Division asked me to read this into the record, and we wholeheartedly agree with what we're doing here today. The intention of the amendments to Chapter 656, the workers' compensation law, are not intended to substantively modify or change the application of the exclusive remedy protections of that law. The bill is drafted to clarify the very limited circumstances where the non-employer of the worker is a public body so that they may be sued for wrongful death claims of injured workers. This bill is not intended to remove existing rights for workers or their beneficiaries to sue third-party private employers. Again, this is a unique situation, and that's what we're here for today. And I know all the members of this committee, except for the newest one, have received the articles that I presented from the Oregonian, Steve Dean. This has captured the state of Oregon. This is an important bill. It needs to be passed this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And somebody, I'll get your, pronounce your name correct.
Sahagian, you'll get it. Thank you.
I read it as I go to the post office every day.
Thanks, all of you.
Okay, thank you. He's the office raised my mind. Across the street. Aaron Knott, Dick Pearson. And Richard Lane also.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice. We appear before you today just for informational testimony on House Bill 4048. The reason we're appearing is we felt it would be helpful for you to have an opportunity to talk to our trial division, as those are the individuals who actually deal with lawsuits against the state. We have three basic objectives in appearing before you today. First of all, to give you a sense of what our current case levels look like that would be implicated by House Bill 4048, cases that maybe weren't, that we're aware of, that weren't brought forward because of the remedy exclusion. Also, the cost of those cases, again, we don't take a position on the cost of those cases. We just want you to know what they are so you can make an informed decision. And finally, whether we would anticipate that the number or type of cases for which the state might be held liable in a wrongful death claim might expand under House Bill 4048. I have alongside me to my left Dirk Pearson. He is the Senior Assistant Attorney General in our Civil Litigation Section and our topical expert on this subject, so I will turn our presentation over to him.
Thank you, Chair Barker, representatives. We wanted to clarify that some of the types of cases that would be affected by this bill if it were passed. Currently, it is correct that it's one of the seven subsets of immunities that the state and other county and local government entities share under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. In other words, we have seven listed instances which exempt that public body from liability under the Oregon Tort Claims Act, the workers' comp provision being one of them. The types of cases that our office has seen where this has been implied is workers killed while driving on a highway within the state of Oregon. I personally had a case up on Highway 26, and the individual was in the process of traveling to his employment and was actually struck when his vehicle struck the back of a logging truck. And they sued the driving team of the logging truck, the lumber company that they were driving to, but also the Oregon Department of Transportation because it occurred on our highway, alleging faulty highway design. Also then, any worker killed while working as a subcontractor for the state of Oregon. This might be a good example. Department of Human Services routinely will have both county employees and subcontractors, even volunteers such as CASA, going in and assisting them in performing their duties throughout the state. Currently, if they were injured and subject to workers' comp claims, the state would be immune from any liability for any injuries, such as if they were attacked and injured by, say, a foster child or foster parent, or even on the way to and from those locations. Workers killed while working for county and local agencies in coordination. And then the other cases that we've seen, ironically, are cases where workers are on the job clearing out forest roads, logging operations, and are tragically killed when something goes wrong, such as landslides or faulty roads. And, of course, we're managing those forest areas, and we have in the past attempted to be sued and gotten out on liability. It's kind of hard to understand what current level cases would be affected by this. One, the Department of Justice doesn't currently have a mechanism for tracking these type of cases. So the cases that we're mentioning here, we're relying upon the institutional knowledge of the line attorneys that have covered those cases. Two, we don't know which cases might not have been brought. Either they're cleared through DAS risk, where someone presents a claim, and we provide the history, the law, the case law, and it convinces the attorney and the estates not to file claims in the first place. And then three, cases like this, where competent counsel sits down with the family and estate, looks at the law, and realizes they don't have a claim. All of those are the hidden cases that we don't know might affect the level of cases brought against the state of Oregon. The cases we do know that I personally had was the case that I talked about where a worker was injured in our forest, and they initially brought suit for $3 million against the Department of Forestry. We also had a case where a subcontractor was injured while working on a Department of Transportation contract work, a construction job, and the estate initially brought a $5.7 million suit against the Oregon Department of Transportation. And then the case with the logging truck incident, they did not claim a value in that, but in speaking with them, the remaining defendants after we were dismissed settled in the high six-figure range in that one. And the plaintiff's counsel thought that they had strong liability against the Oregon Department of Transportation in that case. The other thing that I would bring up in this cost on not knowing which claims would be revised of issue that the committee may raise is the language itself, claims arising on or after May 1st, 2012 language. That is a vague term in our opinion that could lead to additional litigation, and Representative Barton could probably assist you on that. Normally, when we see in the Oregon Tort Claims Act language claims arising, it relates back to an act, the injury or the death, and it gives a date certain. But if you just use the claims arising, there's no legal standard for that. So we don't know if it's the accrual date, which then triggers the discovery clause. So, for instance, is it arising because this committee takes action? That's the first time they have a claim, so it arose on that date. Is it the date that the estate first learned of the wrongdoer's act? And under that, there's a four-pronged test, one of which is that they just found out that the tortfeasor, that being the state actor, was involved in committing the injury to the person. With those, we could have effective dates of May 1st, 2009 as a look-back date. We could have May 1st, 2002 if it went to the ultimate repose statute, or it could go back to the 1967 adoption of the statute if it was if a plaintiff's counsel took the position that the arising on or after May 1st, 2012 was triggered just by the passage of the bill. So that's just something for the committee to consider. Currently, any case that would be brought would be under the $1.9 million cap against the state. It would be, if it reflects back to just the 2011 period, claims back then, as the committee knows, was capped at 1.7. After July 1st of this year, the cap for the state liability will go up to $2 million, and then after that, the committee trigger is in place. We don't know what the raise in the caps will be after that time period.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. Chair Barker, I have a few questions. And first, let me say, although Mr. Pearson, he appears in front of this committee from time to time, I've worked with him in the past. He is really a fabulous lawyer who, a lawyer like this would do a lot better financially if he chose to be in the private sector. And he is really a public servant, and we appreciate everything you do over there. We're lucky to have you, so thank you for your work. A couple questions. And first, I think it will not surprise you if I tell you at the outset I'm sympathetic to the plaintiffs or would-be plaintiffs in this case. And I want to go back to the log truck example on Highway 26 that you used, because I think it might be illustrative. First of all, they did already have a remedy against the log truck company. It was just by virtue of statute that they did not have a remedy against the state, correct?
Correct. In that instance, they brought into the lawsuit the obviously the trucking company itself, right, that was transporting the logs. They also sued the pilot car company that was traveling with them, and the destination lumber yard in which the logs were heading to. And I believe it was actually the lumber company that third-party complaint or attempted the third-party complaint in the state of Oregon under a faulty intersection design.
Yeah. Follow up, if I may.
Please.
So now, let's assume that this bill passed and was active such that they could proceed with a claim, a negligent design claim against the state. Presumably, the state would still essentially be partially shielded by a statute of ultimate repose, which is very often applicable in negligent design cases, which I would note are almost impossible to win anyway. And number two, wouldn't there's still the wrongful death cap, the $500,000 cap, that would apply here, wouldn't it?
Actually, no.
And that doesn't apply against the state?
That is a, speaking of anomalies, what we're referring to is 31-170, which had a cap on non-economic damages of $500,000. It used to be $300,000, but was raised.
1987.
Prior to 2009, that statute specifically exempts claims subject to 3260 et al., the Oregon Tort Claims Act.
Gotcha.
So prior to 2009, that worked in the state's favor in that it was capped at $200,000 for claims against the state under wrongful death suits, where under another private entity have a $300,000 liability. After the 2009 Oregon Tort Claims Act amendments to reflect the OHSU v. Clark rulings, it didn't change. You know, when she went back and changed the language to 3170, so therefore now it is flipped in that the state of Oregon uniquely has a higher limit liability. So we can go up to the caps that are currently 1.9 and then rising, where private entities we've capped non-economically at $500,000.
So I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anybody else have a question?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Richard Lane. I'm a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and here to speak very briefly about the bill. And the first thing I'd say is I would echo all of Representative Witt's comments and agree with them wholeheartedly that this is a unique situation, that there is a bar here that should be eliminated. And the only comments that I would make, if you look at page 2 of the bill, and specifically at line 8, you've taken one class of individuals and now providing them with a remedy, those people that have been killed, but you're leaving people that are injured. So in the situation that we've just talked about, if this family had gone out to administer the drugs and that person ended up being beaten and put into a coma with permanent impairment, medical expenses, that person would not be able to pursue any type of remedy under the circumstances. So it seems there's a principle here that if there is no reason that should bar a wrongful death claim, there should be no reason that an injury claim should be barred. So now you're setting up a situation where, let's say you had two people that were in the same status and they're involved in an accident like counsel just referred to, and one was killed but one was just grievously injured. The grievously injured would still be barred by the existing law, while the wrongful death claimant would be able to pursue a remedy. And from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, if you're going to take a look at this, there should be no reason why you're going to segregate out one class of individuals from another class of individuals. And if you're going to remove the bar, it should be removed for all persons that have a claim that they can pursue their remedy. Thank you, Chair Barker.
But that, one of the problems we're trying to narrowly draw this, because of the huge fiscal cost, if we open that door right open, that's we had this bill up before. We had a lot of people come in with great concerns about that, so that's why we tried to really narrow it down.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I've actually been involved with this for quite some time, session-wise and some of the interim. I understand the concern, but for
a matter of principle, if you're going to say that there shouldn't be a bar to a death claim, there shouldn't be a bar for the injury claim.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Anybody? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, Rob Bovet, Scott Winkles, and Kirk Mylander.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question
yes.
while they're coming up?
Sure.
Do we have a fiscal, a newly drawn fiscal on this?
Chair, members of the committee, we just started. The machines just opened today. No, we do not have a fiscal.
Just checking. Wasn't sure what the timelines are for this.
We do, this bill does not have a referral to Ways and Means Committee.
That was going to be my next question.
Why is that?
Why it doesn't?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is... That's an issue for leadership to put on as far as fiscal. I can tell you we have met several times during the interim in this bill. And I would have to say that a lot of these issues are highly speculative. When we heard from our work groups and the people over at the do workers' comp, there aren't a lot of cases in this area. And then if you narrow it further to the fact that we are talking about people who are killed, not injured, but killed, who were working for a private person at the time. So if you or I were out the weekend and this thing happened, we'd have been able to bring a cause of action. So you're talking about a group here killed, wrongful death, and then you're talking within that a subgroup within that. So you're talking about probably is a very small population. So it would be hard to come up with a number in these things. So.
I understand it would be indeterminate, but still it would seem that that would be an appropriate place for this to go.
Chair, members of the committee, that's a leadership issue. But they're the ones that put that on the bill when it comes to us. Currently, there is no referral to Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you.
Remember to identify yourself for the record going into the order.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rob Levet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. First, I would echo the concerns that you heard from the Department of Justice. I think this bill reaches a greater number of people than we realize in a wide variety of facts. But first, I would posit this notion. I think the remedy that this bill creates for this issue, this tragic issue, which I agree with, needs to be remedied, is actually the wrong remedy. And let me give you an example. It just occurred to me as I'm sitting in the audience. Let's change the facts by one little item. Let's say the home health nurse was a state employee. Even if you pass this bill, that family would receive $16,000. The problem is not the exclusive remedy. The problem is the workers' compensation statutory death benefit for this type of fact pattern. That's exactly what needs to change. So rather than opening up a huge window to a wide variety of liability for local government and state government, we need to surgically go in and fix the problem here, because the death benefit shouldn't have been $16,000. We all recognize that. It should be a greater death benefit. We have recent examples of where police officers have been killed in the line of duty, and the death benefit on those types of cases is upwards of $1 million. We need to not force families, like the family we heard, to litigate whether or not PSRB was liable. The workers' compensation should provide an adequate death benefit. And so, by way of the hypothetical I presented, I think this bill, while laudable, has the wrong remedy. We shouldn't be creating a lawsuit. We should be compensating the family adequately, straight out of the gate.
For the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. Again, the horrific circumstances of this case have highlighted a significant flaw in our workers' compensation statute. And I want to say I appreciate the comments of the bill sponsors and from committee counsel that it's designed to be have a narrow application. But I don't think that is the general consensus on the way this bill has been crafted. And I'm going to read very briefly from the briefing memo that was provided to the Management Labor Advisory Committee that considered this bill on Friday. And this paragraph reads, "The bill may have extremely broad application and implications in any wrongful death action where the decedent was covered by workers' compensation. An action can be brought against any public body that was not the decedent's employer if a theory of liability can be postulated. For example, this could include agencies such as OSHA for working conditions or ODA
or ODOT for road conditions and many others. Again, I would encourage the committee to proceed very cautiously in on this legislation, because I think the wording is broader than I think we intend. And as my colleague, Mr. Bovet, said, the challenge here the answer here is not liability. The answer is that there was a $16,000 death benefit. That is inappropriate. That is not the right number for what happened here. We're not sure what that number is. We'd like to enter into that conversation. But don't make a family go through a protracted litigation process with no surety of an award when we know that exclusive remedy can work, and it's worked well for us in the past, and we urge this committee not to erode that.
Okay, questions? Representative Krieger.
I'd only say, Mr. Chair, at the end, we ought to be thinking what the word justice means, and I haven't seen anyone say that justice came about, so we need to find a solution.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think you are going to hear anybody say that justice came about in this case. It's just a matter of how do we best apply justice. And I guess I would argue that the best justice is to pay an adequate and fair death benefit without the need for litigation.
Chair and members of the committee, if I may, my name is Kirk Mylander. I'm the general counsel at City County Insurance Services. One of my roles is to manage litigation, and we represent almost all of the cities in the state of Oregon and most of the counties. I have personally worked on a couple of cases where this matter was a defense, so we successfully defended a claim that would have been litigated against in both situations, the city. And at those times, the remedy that the injured partied families had through work comp was adequate because they had dependents that met the statutory guidelines under work comp as dependent. One of the sad things here, the people you saw who look very much like dependents of the deceased don't fit the statutory definition of defendant. And that's part of what we think you should fix. Now, if the fix that is put forth by the would-be plaintiffs were to go forward, then we would be defending lawsuits against counties and against cities in cases where an ambulance doesn't arrive quickly enough, a city ambulance, and the deceased say that the city is part at fault, and that's going to cost $150,000 to $200,000 to defend every single time. Or a county road design is faulty, or they claim it's faulty, and a person is in a fatal accident. They blame the county. If they were on the job at the time, this exclusive remedy would make sure that we didn't have to defend that. They could recover through workers' comp. If this is taken away, then we're going to be defending those cases as well. In the logging claim that came up earlier, if those people had dependents under the work comp statute, they could recover a substantial amount of money. What's so strange about this case is that the deceased doesn't have any dependents under the work comp statute. We mentioned law enforcement cases where there was a death of a law enforcement officer. When they've had dependents, the amount that we pay out in work comp is $750,000 to a bit over $1 million. It's a substantial remedy, and that's actually more than what would be paid under a capped wrongful death claim. So it's not that someone must be able to sue in order to get a remedy. And then I'd just like to highlight Mr. Movet's final comment. You know, I manage litigation, so I can tell you that any chance to sue is a risk. A two-year trial down a dark hole, hoping for a payday at the end. And that's all this bill would give the aggrieved in this case. Whereas if you change the workers' compensation statute, they would get money immediately. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Michaels? Anybody else? Any additional? Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I think this last statement was very compelling. Could we bring up the attorney who crafted this legislation?
Yeah. Say again.
Thank you. I was chomping at the bit to say anything, but I know that's not my place.
So,
Representative Tomei.
Thank you.
I want to address it also with questions, of course.
My question is, so why did you craft the legislation as you did? Why didn't you craft legislation regarding workers' comp?
Can you say your name one more time?
Yeah, again, I'm Mike Sahagian.
Thank you.
The attorney for the state. To say I disagree with what was said to you, you found it compelling. Let me tell you why it was not compelling, and maybe that will help answer your question. Because, again, if we start fooling around with the workers' compensation laws, the can of worms we open there is going to be in the extreme. I mean, we all know the grand bargain was struck many years ago, and no one wants to fool around. Just the fact we're even doing this, people are trying to use the exclusive remedy argument, which has nothing to do with this case. So to answer your question point blank, once you start fooling around the actual workers' compensation laws involving employers or non-employers, this session will begin to cover it, where this provides adequate compensation for this particular case and cases like that, which are few and far between. But I want to really strike another point that I think answers your question, and this is the part I found, and I will use the word offensive. To say that dependents, and when we're talking about dependents, we're talking about children under the age of 23, that's the definition of dependents under workers' comp, they would have gotten, for example, lost income and things like that. And they have to be going to school. So it's under 23 and going to school. In this particular fact pattern, to say this young woman and her granddaughter are not dependents in the classic sense, that's just using statutory terms. All children, whatever their age, and sometimes grandchildren, are entitled to their parents' estate. They are. There is no estate now. This lady has passed away. She was in her late 30s when she passed away. She'll never have an estate. That's what we're talking about here. So to use the word dependents, there are no dependents. There are dependents. There's always dependents as long as there's children or grandchildren. And that was the point I was really chomping the bit at. I hope that also helps answer the other part of why we fashioned this bill.
My intent was not to set up a debate, but to understand why you didn't go after workers' comp. So thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill came up at the end of last session as an amendment to another bill. Chair asked me to put together a work group. We met periodically during the interim. We had representatives of safety. We had representatives of the Department of Justice. We had Representative Whitley, Mrs. Hagan, and others there. We did discuss the workers' compensation issue, and he's right. It's a complex issue. But you've got to remember, we're talking about a very small population.
Right.
We're talking about people who are working at the time, who are not working for the state. They're working for a private entity. So if you look at a workers' compensation model to up the death benefits for circumstances like this, you're not just doing it for people who are injured by the state, who are working at the time. You are talking about doing it for everyone across all employment aspects. And that caused concerns among people from safe there, and it's a bigger issue than this.
So if I may ask a question to Mr. Taylor. So was that the consensus of the work group to go with this rather than looking at workers' comp?
Chair, members of the committee, SAFE was more comfortable with us going this route. I know Mr. Sahagian was. And I didn't hear, when we got through, anyone still advocating for a workers' comp model at the time.
No. Okay.
I'm not going to say that local government was there. They've had some changes in representation since last session. But the Department of Justice was there, and they have similar interests. So it's just a different issue from this and a considerably more complex issue than this.
I can understand that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You know, it seems to me, colleagues, we deal with issues like this once or twice per session, and it's kind of what, to use Representative Krieger's word, like justice versus fiscal type debate. I recall this issue came up. We also had one involving victims of childhood sex abuse against the state last time. I remember Representative Parrish had the bill, and we couldn't quite make it work. I hope we will look at that issue again in 15. And, you know, it's legitimate, and I'm not offended by it, even though I get emotional. You know, the opponents of the bill, they're just representing the interests of their client, and they have some very legitimate points that we need to weigh. But again, I think Representative Krieger's point, where is the justice in this? Where we have to balance some competing interests and draw lines that will never be entirely comfortable. But, you know, as I see Jesse Warren there and her adorable daughter at 3.5 months, I just really feel that where the line is drawn right now is not right. And I would love to explore way, and I think this is a pretty fair approach. As Richard Lane said, actually, this arguably is unfair, even as, because it doesn't apply to injuries for no principled reason whatsoever. So I think this actually is a reasonable compromise, in my opinion. Again, I do respect differing opinions on this. There's no entirely comfortable solution. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank all of you.
Close the work, the public hearing on House Bill 4048. And we can't move to a work session today because we don't have the fiscal, but so we'll close the meeting. Is there any further business to come before the committee today? Thank you, committee. Adjourned.